Hi, everybody. My name is Eddie, and I'm an alcoholic. He lies about other things, too. This is like homecoming for me because I was a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous in this area for some 3 or 4 years back in the early 70s, and it's nice to be back. It's nice to be back for a lot of reasons, and let me just tell you that I'm grateful for the invitation to come here and to try to share a little bit of our experience, strength, and hope with each other this weekend. I want to thank the committee. I want to thank Ann in particular for being kind enough to invite me to come down here, for the opportunity to renew old friendships, to pick up on old friendships. Jim Wright and I spent many, many a day together. Tommy's over here. Glenn's back there. Bill's back there. There's a lot of people here. Flip is unique, you know. I mean, I picked up with a conversation today with Flip that we left off 21 years ago. You know, he didn't miss a beat. He just said, let me finish that story. off we went. And it's that's really a love affair when you can do that, when you can get back with people that you've cared about and have kept in touch with over the years and sit and be comfortable with men, look them in the eye and let them know that you love them and they love you and there's nothing to be ashamed about in that. And you don't even have to put your head down. You know, you don't even have to blush when you say it. It's a privilege. But it wasn't always that way. It wasn't always that way, and that's what we're here to discuss tonight, alcoholism and recovery from alcoholism as best we understand it. I took my last drink of alcohol or any of its substitutes on the 3rd of September, 1962. Now, that's strictly by the grace of God as expressed to me through this fellowship here. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was not my intention to stop drinking. That was the last thing on my mind. I did want to get out of trouble, but I didn't particularly want to stop drinking. I was too young, and I had deeper problems, and the signs still looked good, and the bar stools were there, and the dirty-legged blondes were running around, you know, and I didn't really want to be in here. I wanted to be out there, but out there wasn't working. It wasn't working at all. It wasn't even working a little bit, so I had to come here to get the heat off, and a strange thing happened to me over the time that I was in AA, and if it happens to you, you're probably the luckiest person in the world. And what happened to me is this, that as I stayed around AA long enough, the truth punched its way through to me. The truth about alcoholism punched its way through to me. The truth about me punched its way through to me. The truth about recovery and the nature of recovery punched its way through to me. I wasn't a volunteer. I'm going to do two things tonight. I'm going to try to do two things tonight. I'm going to try not to talk about anything that hasn't happened to me, but it's not my own personal experience and opinion. And I'm going to try to tell you the absolute truth. That's a tall order for an alcoholic. Alcoholics do not tell the truth easily. They save it for emergencies. When all else fails, you tell the truth. When the hounds are at your throat and you're backed up in a corner, then you tell the truth. Otherwise, lie. My sponsor, who was a very wise man, said, there's a way for certain that you can tell when a new alcoholic is lying. I say, what's that, Joe? He said, if his lips move, he's lying. And that was the truth about me then. Now I'm going to tell you that it's probably more difficult for you to believe than I'm going to tell you the truth because I have to tell you a few things about myself. One, I'm a member of the CIA. That's Catholic, Irish, and alcoholic. Second, I make my living as a criminal defense attorney. And we really don't spread the truth around too carelessly, you see. It's more than an emergency. It's almost a national defense alert by the time you have to tell the truth. And, of course, I kid around about that a little bit. In any event, let me just get started by telling you about my last drunk first. Because it kind of describes what kind of a genius I was when I drank alcohol. On the morning after the night before my last drunk, I woke up in a dark room. I was sitting on the edge of the bed with my head between my hands and, brain operating in slow time. If somebody gave me a cigarette, they would have had to tell me that you light it next. And I thought I was in my room at McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey because I was busy keeping the world safe for democracy at that time. And I looked around the room and there was a person in the bed with me that I had never seen before in my life, ever. And I looked around at the walls and began to realize that something was amiss and got up and went out the door, looked around, and I knew that I was in deep trouble. because where I was in Africa. And I didn't know how the hell I got to Africa. And I didn't know what part of Africa I was in. And all alcoholics are geniuses. I'm no exception. We know there are certain questions you just can't ask. You can't do it. Right? No matter how sick you are, you can't ask certain questions. You cannot go up to a stranger and say, pardon me, sir, what country am I in? Can you tell me what day it is, you know, within 2 or 3 months? Do you remember my name? You can't do that. So you invent conversations. Find somebody, if you're lucky like me, who speaks a little bit of English and Italian, wandering around in Ethiopia. And, how you doing? Good, how are you? You live here? Yeah. Well, sooner or later, you can lead them to the place of telling you where they live, see? And if they live here, and they say here is Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and you're a genius, you can conclude maybe you're in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, see? And that's where I was, but I didn't know where I was supposed to be in that country or why at the time. Came back to me a little bit later, but I didn't know. I looked in my pockets, I had a key that said the Royal Haile Selassie Hotel, and I was hoping that wherever I was wasn't too far from there. And I got back there, things began to come back to me. I was sent over there with the Air Force. I was the crew navigator for all things. I got lost in the air, too, lots of times. Frequently and to excess. I show up at this hotel. Things began to come back to me that I was sent over there to fly missions in the Congo because it was in flames or something of that sort at the time. And the Air Force was gone, see? Now, I didn't know whether they were coming back or not. Now, obviously they did because I wouldn't be here tonight, neither somebody else, just for openers. And I sat at that hotel bar and had 3 drinks of whiskey just to calm my nerves. And those were the last 3 drinks of alcohol or any of the substitutes that I've had to take from that day to this. And it wasn't because that got my attention. You know, I spent my whole life having people and things get my attention. You know, most alcoholics go through life and they have a whole series of getting attentions. And that's maybe why they get sober and maybe why they continue to progress a little bit in sobriety, because things get their attention. Well, that got my attention that day. And I didn't drink. Now, I got to tell you that was 6 months after I joined AA that happened to me. And that's how this program works if you don't help it along a little bit. You know, if you don't stop drinking and try to do something to help it along. I'll back up a little bit. I grew up in upstate Pennsylvania. Irish Catholic household, a good household. My father was a coal miner. I should add that he was a black lung coal miner. We were poor, a lot of kids. When I was 17 years old, I joined the service, joined the Navy. Couldn't wait to get in the service. Was sent to Korea with a squadron. I was a plane pusher and an ammo loader and went to Korea during the Korean War, spent a year there and came back. I came back to Corpus Christi, Texas. It's kind of important for me to look back to that place and that time, you see, because the first symptoms of alcoholism, as I understand alcoholism to be, that is from the perspective of the now time, with 20/20 hindsight, when you can look back and see it, the first symptoms of alcoholism, as I understand them to be, began to occur in my life. And they began to occur in my life because I did things that got people's attention. I don't think I was any different from the average 19-year-old veteran that was hanging out on that base at that point in time. You wouldn't have seen me as being different from the others. We all went out on Friday night and sat on the bar stool and got stone drunk. And once in a while, one of the guys had some funny weed, you know, that they'd smoke. And I never did because that was not for me. It was, you know, booze was enough. So I can remember sitting on that stool and lying about all the women we chased. We all lied about the women we chased. We just never told anybody. We never caught any, see? We just sat on the stool and lied about it, you know. And occasionally you get in a fight and you have a black eye and who cares? The next day you get up. I was into sports. We played a lot of sports. Felt a little bit sick, but it's not a problem. Saturday night you do the same thing. Well, didn't take long for this guy to work that up to doing it on Sunday night. And I can remember the first time I missed work on Monday morning. Because I was drunk. I fell asleep in a cotton field on the way back to the base and didn't get there, and I had a nice white uniform on that was stained and dirty, and that wasn't the first or the last uniform that I wore that was stained and dirty with various body fluids that, you know, stain and dirty uniforms. But I remember running down to see this chief petty officer I worked for because I was ashamed of myself, missing duty. It was one of the things you don't do. And he kind of laughed when he saw me, and he said, ho, don't worry about that. All good sailors do that. Go take a shower, come back to work. So I did. You know, about the 15th time that I did that, he didn't say, ho. He called me 16 kinds of an SOB instead of saying, ho. And if you don't shape up, this will happen to you. Better shape up or else. Better do this or else. Better turn over a new leaf or else. Now, I cite that, and I cite that relationship with my superior, who was like a father figure, because I began to do things back then that I think led me into some serious drinking, or allowed me to do some serious drinking. And one of them is kind of magical, because if you think about the things that we did when we drank, our collective experiences with the booze, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that something's dramatically wrong. You know, a low-grade idiot with a tight hat could follow most of us around and say, something is really amiss with this person here. But the being seems to be able to ignore that. Otherwise intelligent people such as us seem to be able to ignore what's happening. Now, I look back to that time in Corpus Christi, Texas, and to that chief petty officer, and I can tell you exactly how I got to ignore what was going on. Because when he was getting on my back for what I was doing wrong, like magic one day, and I mean it came like a flash from the blue, I figured out it was his fault. What was wrong with me was his fault, see. Now, if you can do that, you can go places with this disease. If you can do one more thing, if you can do one more thing that I did, and a lot of us do, if you get to the place where the only voice you hear is the voice of the idiot that lives in your head, you can get to outer space with alcohol. I guarantee you, you can go there, because the voice will suggest things that are downright bizarre. For instance, one time I was walking down the streets of Corpus Christi, Texas at 3 o'clock in the morning. I had eliminated all friends from my life because, if you start fights and can't finish them and somebody else has to take the lumps, they don't want you around much longer. If you live in the barracks and you're always bumming money, they don't necessarily want to be available for you to bum money from. If you're the kind of a person that I got to be, where you don't spend money washing your clothes and they just hang in a bag at the foot of your bunk and guys walk by and green film forms over their eyes when they go by your laundry bag, they don't want much to do with you. So you're out there drinking. If you're like me, you drink alone. And if you drink alone, you have conversations with the idiot that lives in your head, see? And I was walking down the streets of Corpus Christi, Texas at 3 o'clock in the morning one night, and I saw this woman's wash on the line. Men's clothes, women's clothes, pants, brassiere, slip shirts, panties, you name it. It was there. And the voice in my head said, why don't you take those things? And I said, good idea. So I took them all. And then I put them all on, see? Men's clothes, women's clothes, pants, brassieres, slips, shirts, 40 pounds of clothing on me, walking down the streets in Corpus Christi, Texas at 3 o'clock in the morning. If you do that, you will draw a cop. I guarantee you. And the cop will say to you, what are you doing? And if you're like me, that happened 40 years ago, I think, thereabouts. If you're like me, you will not be able to think of an intelligent answer to that question to this day. Because I don't know what the hell I was doing. But I got locked up. And I was thrown in the pokey. And the next day when I woke up, I looked over in a corner and there's a pile of clothes there. And right on the top is a pair of panties and a brassiere. And I wasn't too sure about myself in those days anyway, so I say, you didn't do that. And the voice says, oh, yes, you did. And I can't stand it. I can't stand it. I don't know why I did it. I can't stand it. I know something. I know not so much that I'm going to be in trouble, because even the judge laughed when he heard about what was happening in you know, he didn't do much to me. But I knew those guys back at the base that I wasn't getting along with were going to find out, not that I was in jail, but why I was in jail. And I couldn't stand it. And to make it easier to bear the pain and the shame that came from drinking, alcoholically, I took a drink of alcohol, because it makes it easier to bear the pain and the shame. And if you're an alcoholic, I didn't know I was, but if you're an alcoholic, it's only a matter of time, if you're like me, till you drink to excess again. And as you drink to excess again, you'll get into another jam. And to make it easier to bear the pain and the shame of that next jam, you'll take a drink of alcohol, and sooner or later you'll drink to excess, and you get into another jam, you know? Until the jams get closer and closer together, till you're ready to fly right up your hole behind. It's getting that tight in the circle. If you have principles that you live by, and everybody has them, mine might not be yours. I didn't have many, but, you know, I had them. Certain things you don't do. They come between you and taking a drink. If you're like me, they go one by one. So it's no mystery when we get here, at least in my mind, in this drunk's mind, why we're bankrupt spiritually, why we're ashamed of ourselves, why we can't sit in a dark room and think about what we did, much less tell another human being. But that's another story. Life goes on. I was a second-class petty officer, and I worked my way down to a no-class petty officer. I got more and more bizarre and seedy. I would make efforts to get ahead in life because I knew that inside this being was a genius just waiting to be discovered, you know. And the more you drink, the more you can dream those kind of weird dreams, and that's the way it was with me. I didn't care about anybody. I didn't have many dates. If you smell like I smelled, you wouldn't have many dates either. One day I saw a notice on the bulletin board, and it said, fleet-wide competition for appointments to Annapolis. I said, that's for me. So I went and took the tests, and I got to tell you something about myself. I'm a test taker, and that's not a virtue. That's just a fact. And I can take tests better than anybody I know. If you were to give me a test in nuclear physics about which I know nothing, if it was multiple choice and you let me read it, I guarantee you I could pass it. I don't know how, but I guarantee you I could pass it. And that's kind of been the way my life went with respect to tests. So I took these tests. And to make a long story short, I got one of those appointments to the Naval Academy. They gave out 20 or 30 that year to the enlisted corps in the Navy and the Marine Corps. And I wasn't surprised. I was not surprised. I thought, somebody has recognized my genius. Not a doubt in my mind. I'd go to that academy. I'd graduate. I'd be an ensign. Somewhere down the line, I'd be an admiral. I'd get a battleship. I'd get those SOBs that are getting me, you know. And that was the dream, but that was the way it was going to be. Only between the time I got the appointment and the time I was to report, I went out to celebrate. And I don't know what I was celebrating. It might have been my birthday, it might have been Monday night or something, but I was out celebrating. And I did something else at the suggestion of this voice. I stole an automobile, see, for the first time. Somebody left it in the parking lot of the gin mill with the keys in it. And the voice said to me, why don't you take it? And I said, good idea, and I took it. And I took that car, I have to tell you, never having had a driver's license and not knowing how to drive a car, see. But I got it started and I got it in first gear. But I didn't know how the hell to get it from first gear to second gear. Now, if you're going down the highway at about 20 miles an hour, 30 miles an hour in first gear, it sounds like a spad. It sounds like an old airplane trying to get off the deck. And if you do that, what's going to happen? You're going to draw the cop again. All alcoholics are absolute geniuses. I'm no different. Cop pulls right up behind me. Cool as could be, I eased that car over to the side of the road. Shut it off. Slid over to the passenger side. That didn't impress him a bit. So I opened the passenger door, got out, and crawled under the car to hide from the cop that was watching me do it. And he sat on the curb with his flashlight and waited for me to come out. And this time they didn't laugh. You know, this time they had the handcuffs on. And this time I was looking at some big trouble, and this time I cried when I was in jail. And this time the Navy that I hated and the commanding officer I had, who was the worst kind of a tyrant in the world, all came down and said, don't send this young man to a Texas prison. He's a Korean War veteran. Give him back to us, and we will court-martial him. And they did. Give me back to them, and they did court-martial me, and I quit drinking, see? I quit drinking forever because I knew this was nuts. You know, this just wasn't bad luck. This wasn't being in the wrong place. This wasn't not having enough education. This wasn't having the wrong parents. This was nuts. And I knew it. I knew booze had something to do with it, so I quit drinking. I quit forever. I never swore off. I'd never touch another drink of alcohol as long as I lived. And it, for me, it lasted a short period of time, maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And it wasn't because I didn't want to be straight at the time. I did very much want to be straight. I knew nothing about the disease of alcoholism. But I'm like everybody that I ever knew in AA when I tell their story and get down right down to the root of it. If you don't have a substitute, and booze is the only answer you've ever had to the question of living, I don't know what the hell the question is, but if booze is the only answer you've ever had, you can't give it away. You have to keep it. Maybe a lousy answer, but if it's the only one you got to hang on to it. Kind of like that pitcher there. That pitcher's four-fifths of the way full. And that's the way I used to feel the first day sober without booze. And then somebody pour a glass full in, and then another glass full in, and it spills out over the top. And that's the way it operated with me, because sober, every resentment and every fear and every hatred and every inadequacy that I felt in my life would pile one day on top of another day on top of another day till 2 or 3 weeks go by and you're carrying it around and you don't know anything. You have to drink. You have to drink. And I drank. And I just got weirder and severe as time went on. I got out of that Navy after 4 years. I went back to my hometown in Pennsylvania. My parents saw me go away a rebellious teenager. They saw me come back a nut. You know, just a nut. I wouldn't work. I just drank. I get into fights in my hometown. I get into fights with my brothers. I get into fights with my uncles. I get into fights with everybody. I never won a single fight. I just get into fights. I set the house on fire one time, smoking cigarettes in bed and passing out. I was home about 3 months, and I stole another car in my hometown of 600 people. I stole the only police car in the town. Seemed like a good idea at the time. If you do that, you really do get their attention. I mean, you really do get their attention if you take their car. They caught me at home. They told me to leave or else. I knew what the or else was, so I left. And I kind of got lost in America. I went to New Jersey and got a job in an automobile factory and got fired after a month because I didn't show up often enough. I moved down to Philadelphia and got a job in a machine shop and got fired because I didn't show up often enough. And then I went down to Baltimore, Maryland and got a job tending bar and I got fired because I drank too much of the booze that was there. And went to D.C. and I'm flipping hamburgers in a White Tower restaurant, working my way up, you see, in the world, and fell asleep in the chili pot one day and, you know, get fired from that with chili beans in my ears. And I lived in boarding houses. I was always going to do things. Alcoholics are always going to do things. They're going to do it tomorrow now, you know, mañana, but they're always going to do things. We have plans. Tomorrow I'm going to go to college on a GI Bill and get myself an education, but in the meantime I'm sick and I need to have a drink, so I'll have a drink and, you know, one semester goes by and another semester goes by and nothing happens. Next payday, I'm going to save enough money to get myself some decent civilian clothes here instead of these rags I'm wearing. And right now, I need to spend the money to get a couple of drinks, and I'll do it next week. And next week comes and goes, and nothing happens. One of these days, I'm going to get myself straightened out here to where I'll have enough money to put a down payment on an automobile because everybody else my age has a car, and I don't have one. Months go by. Nothing happens. One of these days I'm going to get myself cleaned up and get my teeth fixed because they're rotting out of my head. Get those teeth fixed so that I can have a date with that good-looking blonde that I saw down the street here. And nothing ever happened. Nothing ever happened. I just got seedier and weirder. I lived in boarding houses. I got fired from every job I ever had. I got arrested in that town. I got arrested for stealing a woman's purse in a gin mill. Put it in the back of my shirt. It's hanging out like a knapsack. Cop comes in and says, give the lady back her purse. I say, what purse? What purse? It's hanging out there like a knapsack. Used to go to great lengths to get even with the cops. Used to set off false fire alarms. One time I set one off across the street from the boarding house where I lived, and ran around a corner and climbed a tree just to wait for the fire engines and the police to come. And they did. And it's the middle of January, and I'm up in the tree, and there's not a leaf on that tree. And it's 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and they say, come down. All alcoholics are geniuses, you see, and I'm a 200-pound genius canary sitting up in a tree waiting to come down. I have to tell you that I didn't bother telling my parents where I was because I didn't need them anymore, and I didn't care about them, and I didn't care much about my brothers or my sister or anybody else in the world. I wish I didn't have to tell you that, but that was the way it was. I think that I, in part at least, wanted to become the kind of a person who didn't feel and therefore couldn't be hurt or wounded or anything. And God forgive me, if this disease hadn't squeezed the arrogance out of me, I think I was on the verge of becoming that kind of a human being. And they're very scary people. I sit across tables sometimes from poor, unfortunate beings who don't have consciences and don't have feelings. And they are scary. And they are wounded. And they're dangerous. And I think I came very close to being that kind of a person. I hope not. But I think I was trying to work on that very hard. And then this disease finally squeezed the arrogance out of me enough to listen to a different message. I tried to turn over a new leaf again by accident. Sitting in a park bench, fired. Alexandria, Virginia, and I saw a sign across the street that said in front of the post office, join the Air Force. And I thought, that's for me. Now, I had a pair of coveralls on with salt stains down to my waist, and I had a mouthful of rotten teeth, and I had long hair, and I had a beard. And I went in to see this recruiting sergeant who wanted nothing to do with me, absolutely nothing to do with me. But I insisted that I was an honorably discharged veteran, and, you know, he needed my kind. And I insisted on my rights. And I think to get rid of me, he gave me his tests. And the biggest mistake he ever made, because I probably scored higher than anybody he'd had in years. And I went in the Air Force. Got my head shaved and beard shaved and clean uniform and some meals. And on the basis of the scores that I had on those initial tests, I was given some further testing, Air Force officer's qualification test, two-year college equivalency test, flight aptitude test, you name it, and I took them. And apparently I did very well on them because I got an appointment to the Aviation Cadet Program, which is improbable, but nonetheless that happened. I was a magnificent physical specimen when I got there, having never lifted anything heavier than a drink in about 4 or 5 years. I used to check my body. Drunks check their body, you know what I mean? Usually when they're coming out of the shower and they go by the mirror and they take a look at what's in there and then they want to check it out. I used to stand there and try to make a muscle and nothing happened. I mean, absolutely nothing happened. Nothing at all happened. I was in my 20s, but nothing happened. Absolutely nothing. There was bone and skin, that's it. You know, nothing else happened. So I show up for cadet training and I figure, you know, second shot at genius here. This time I won't screw it up. And if I can't be an admiral, I'll be a general. And I'll get a bomber, you know, and I'll get those SOBs with the bomber instead of the battleship. And this was the plan. And I got very sick and because we had to do physical training. And for the first 3 months, I remember vomiting every day, every day. But I didn't drink, couldn't drink, wasn't allowed to drink, at least the first part of it. And I graduated. I graduated as a distinguished graduate and went to McGuire Air Force Base as a second lieutenant to fly as a navigator on a transport aircraft. And I thought I'd arrived. I was going to get myself an apartment in town, convertible automobile, meet those blondes instead of whatever I used to meet. Life would be good. This was the dream. And I started to drink because I didn't know a thing about alcoholism. And I thought I'd drink from the top shelf. And I saw people drinking martinis, and that's what I thought was good. You know, I used to like Muscatel wine, to tell you the truth, and cheap gin. And I drank cheap gin again, and ultimately went right back to Muscatel wine. But I started to drink. I was welcomed aboard as a distinguished graduate and, you know, perhaps a good prospect for the squadron. In the next 6 months, I was in the local jail 6 times. Once I was chained to the wall because I wouldn't shut up. And the commanding officer had to come down and get me out, and I'm in uniform. Another time I went to Philadelphia and took a nosedive right on the sidewalk because I got into some arguments with some people over there, again in uniform, half ripped off my back. I mean, I was a shining example to everybody. I spent a month in an Air Force hospital because I ruptured a varicosity in my throat and was vomiting sinkfuls of blood and wouldn't go near the doctor because they were the enemy. And they might find out what's wrong with me and what's going on here. And I didn't know what was going on, and I was ashamed of it, so you don't let them find out. I did other things that got their attention. If you can't show up to go on a flight because you fell down on the way out to the airplane and cracked your skull open on the way out, and the blood's running down your face, it gets their attention. If you start to have visions and hear voices, as I did toward the end, and you tell somebody about it, it gets their attention. It particularly gets their attention if you tell them about the little critters that are running around in the airplane when you're in it. See? If you see a mouse coming out of the instrument panel, for future reference, don't ever tell anybody about it. Finally, I'm court-martialed, grounded, mandatory visits to the psychiatrist. I'm bleeding again, vomiting blood. I can't leave my room in the barracks. I'm slipping and sliding on the commode with blood and snot running out of my nose and saying to myself, who cares? I don't care. Who cares? I don't care. And something happened to me that was the first of a series of coincidences that really aren't coincidences. I used to say I found AA at this point in time, but that's not entirely true. What happened was AA found me, and it found me in the guise of the fellow that lived next door to me. We shared a bathroom, and one day when I was sliding into the commode with the snot hanging out of my nose, as, you know, civilized as that sounds, Kurt, who's a great big second lieutenant pilot from Texas, standing in the doorway, and I said, as I was crying and vomiting, I said, my God, I got to stop drinking. And he said to me, do you mean that? And I said, yes. I meant no, but I said yes. And this was in 1962 when nobody, to my knowledge, on that Air Force base knew about alcoholism. And they certainly didn't know about alcoholism in 28-year-old young officers. The one guy on that base that knew all about alcoholism was standing in the doorway when I first said, my God, I got to stop drinking. And Kurt knew about alcoholism because Kurt's father was an alcoholic. And Kurt told me about his father. Kurt told me about his dad going to a Texas prison for 2 years for doing what alcoholics do best, writing bad checks. Kurt told me about when he was 16 years old, having to sit on his father's chest while the old man pulled the lizards off when he was going through the DTs. Kurt told me about being raised by a series of relatives because his parents got divorced because of his father's drinking. And finally, Kurt says to me, tells me about his father going to AA and never drinking again. Now, I know what's coming. I'm not stupid. Kurt says to me, you should go to AA. I was indignant. I said, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And he laughed. He did just what you did. And he laughed and he said, well, I don't know, Ed, but they'll never turn you down. So, at his expense in his car, he made the call. He snuck me off the base. We went to the Salvation Army building to meet the guy who was the president of AA. I didn't want any part of this deal, but I had a fat lip and a black eye, which was my usual disguise, and Kurt's bigger than me, and he's pushing me in the door. And I have a raincoat with the collar turned up because I didn't want to lose my reputation, see, by being seen going into the Salvation Army building. We get up to the door. There's an absurd sign over the door. It's an awful sign. And it says, actually, some of the best advice I ever got in my life, but it didn't seem like it at the time. There's a sign over the door, and it said, when your knees knock, kneel. So we go up to the door, and that's great advice. In fact, I use that advice. I take that advice. We went up to the door to go in to meet Joe, who's the president of AA. Now, most people have sponsors that they say, lots of people, they have sponsors that act like sergeant majors. Well, I walked into the Salvation Army building with a fat lip, black eye, and a bad case of the shakes with Kurt behind me. I went up to see the captain of the Salvation Army to ask who Joe was, the president of AA, and he points over in the corner, and he says, "That's Joe over there. He's waiting for you fellas." And I looked over in the corner, and I knew the guy that was sitting over there. I didn't know him personally, but I knew him because everybody on McGuire Air Force Base knew that guy. Because sitting over there was the base sergeant major, see? The meanest man on McGuire Air Force Base. I mean, this guy joined the Army with Custer, probably, because he was in forever. And, I mean, he was a mean SOB. Everybody was terrified of him. And he's sitting over there, and he's waiting for me, and I don't want any part of this deal. Except I can't get out. So I have to go over. Joe asked me the questions. "Do you drink?" "Yes." "How much do you drink?" "A lot." "How much is a lot?" I tell him. He says, "Yeah, that's a lot." And he said, I said, "Yes." I meant no, but I said yes. And he said, "When?" I think any answer other than right now, he'd have told me to come back. I said, "Right now." "Fine, sit down." Gets me a cup of coffee. Finally, he says to me, "By the way, what's your rank?" I didn't have any rank on. And, you know, just as arrogantly as I said it, I said, "Second lieutenant." And I got to quote his answer verbatim, because it defined our relationship from that on. He said, and I quote, "I'll be a son of a bitch. I've been waiting 20 years to get my hands on a second lieutenant." Sit down. And I sat with the sergeant major who's long in his grave and learned about the journey towards sobriety. And I was a very reluctant candidate. As far as I know, I was the first of the higher paid help to get into that group. They were all old NCOs. They were glad to have me, man. I mean, they had a prized pig here, you know, by the throat, and they'd go sit in the corner, shut up. 90 days sober, you can go out. "My name is Eddie, I'm an alcoholic, and I've been sober for 90 days. That's enough, sit down, shut up. But they loved me to death. They took me to meetings, they went to see the CO to get the arrest lifted so that I could go to meetings. I had to be back by midnight or I turned into a pumpkin, but I could go to meetings. The body began to heal. The fat lip went away. Black eyes went away. I stayed sober for a couple of months, got drunk because I couldn't stand it any longer. Stayed sober a couple more months, got drunk because I couldn't stand it. Stayed sober a couple more months and went on my last drunk, which I just told you about earlier. And then one day I didn't take a drink of alcohol, and that day went further. I wish I could stand here and tell you that something special happened to enlighten me that day, but it really didn't. And that's a very important message, I think, for all of us. As we come to AA meetings, when we first come here, I came here, I used to listen to people, and it almost sounded as if there was a clap of thunder and the clouds parted and a finger came down and everybody was healed except me. You know, I'm sitting back in the back thinking, "Jesus, what's wrong with me? What in the hell's the matter with me? Everybody else has no trouble with disease and I'm nuts. I want to kill people. I'm nuts about without the booze." I stayed sober. I went to meetings. My sponsor bugged me about taking the steps. He would drive me to meetings. He would make me go on 12-step calls with him till I got to like some of the alcoholics that I met. I got to appreciate the fact that I could be of some use to somebody, take them to meetings. I didn't want anything to do with the steps because I was an atheist. And if you're an atheist, everybody knows you don't have to take the steps because they involve God and you don't have to do that. I would listen to people that I learned to love in AA stand at podiums just like this and make God references. And I used to be embarrassed, not for me, for them, because they believed in ghosts and I was just too smart for that. And that's nonsensical. And what in the name of sanity does writing down every rotten thing you ever did in your life have to do with not drinking? And certainly you're not going to tell anybody about it. There were things I had done. I'm not going to think about sitting over in that corner, much less tell you. Don't be silly. I mean, you tell me, but I'm not telling you about what I did. So I saw no point in that, and I stayed sober on what I call momentum, and that's probably the best word for it. I stayed sober going to 7 meetings a week. I stayed sober buying convertible automobiles with the money that accumulated in my pocket. I stayed sober by taking people to meetings who were newcomers because I got a lot of attention as a result of doing that. I stayed sober by chasing blondes, brunettes, redheads, and spending money and taking good vacations and doing everything else under the sun except look at the self. And I'll tell you something. I strung that out for a couple of years. And I'll tell you this much, too, that had not something happened to me, and I could have stayed sober on momentum, I would still be doing that. Except those of us that are fortunate enough have the kind of personality that will not let us stay sober indefinitely on momentum. We have the kind of a personality that will get our attention sober, hard, quick, swift, on the wrong day. I suffer from the wrong day syndrome, see? Now, on the wrong day, sober, if I walk into the air operations office and two guys are talking, and they shut up when I walk in the door, they could be talking about women or sports or the Air Force, because those are the only three things anybody ever talked about that I remember in the Air Force, in the Air Ops office. But if they shut up when I walked in the door, they were talking about me. Now, if you gave me 12 hours on the wrong day to think about that, I could tell you exactly what they said, even though I didn't hear a word. If you gave me 24 hours or 36 hours to brood on it, then it was time to dynamite their desk, put hand grenades in the desk drawer, and tie the pin to the handle so that when it opens, it'll explode and they'll die because of what they said about me, even though I hadn't heard a word. Now, two or three days without sleep, it passes. And you say to yourself, yeah, that's nuts. But just don't let it happen again. So 2 months goes by, and it happens again. The next time it happens, you're driving down the street and some teenager cuts you off, you know, in your new convertible automobile. And it's the wrong day. So it's time to hightail it after them, cut them off, leap out of the car like a maniac with a tire iron and smash their windshield because they deserve it, see? And then realize what you've done and run away because the cops are going to be called. And that passes, and of course you say, that's nuts, just don't let that happen again. And nothing does happen again for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days, and it happens again to you. And it culminated for me. One day at the meeting of the young people's group that I had helped to found in that area up there between flights. And one of my best friends in AA, somebody sicker than me, said, this guy's talking about you. So it was the wrong day to tell me that. So I brooded on it, and that night we went to the meeting, and I walked in the door, and my friend Andy says, hi, how you doing? And I smacked him in the mouth, you know, and knocked him down. And he got up and smacked me in the mouth and knocked me down. And we rolled around on the floor at the AA meeting, setting a good example for the newcomer. And I got up and went outside and sat by a tree and cried and went to see my sponsor and I told him I was going to get drunk, and he agreed with me and said, yeah. And I said something to him to save my life. And I meant it. I said, I don't want to. I don't want to get drunk. He said, You don't want to get drunk? You don't want to get drunk bad enough to do anything? I said, yeah, I don't want to get drunk. I really don't want to get drunk. I'd come to love AA. I'd come to love you. Whatever it was you had punched its way through to me after two or three years around. And it punched its way through to the extent I didn't want to get drunk. And I'm crying. And I said, I have to. And he said, well, not if you're willing to do something. And he told me before, what is that? Those are the 12 steps. I went through my usual argument with him about the God references and my atheism, and therefore I can't do this. And he said to me, what has the fourth step got to do with God? Read literally, nothing. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I started in the middle, and I had to admit to him, nothing. And he said, then do it. Go home and do it. And I said something to him that I think saved my life. Great word. I said, okay. I said, okay. He said, how do you do that, Joe? I don't know how to do that. He pointed me to pages, I think it's 66 through 72. Don't hold me to that, but it's right in there in chapter 5 in the big book. Pointed me to 12 and 12. Made suggestions to me that I follow those guidelines and write out this four-step inventory. And he said, by the way, why don't you start with the worst thing you ever did in your life? Now, I knew what the worst thing was that I ever did in my life, because it was stuck right there in my throat as soon as he said it. And the worst thing I ever did in my life, I got to tell you about, and don't particularly want to. Worst thing I ever did in my life, I did to my father. My father was no Irishman. Never gave me anything but love. He was a black lung coal miner. He was an old man. When I was a young man, home from the Navy, running amok in my hometown, and getting run out of my hometown. And my father was as tall as me, weighed about 85 pounds, and he was on his deathbed, and I was his oldest son. And with the peculiar kind of logic that comes with this disease, as he was lecturing me about the scandalous behavior I was indulging in and the effect it was having on my mother, my sister, and my younger brothers, as he was lecturing me about this, it seemed to me that what was wrong with me was his fault. So I told that old man that it was his fault. I told him that it was the worst thing that ever happened to me was to have him for a father. That he was the sorriest excuse for a man that I ever saw in my life. And that if I never saw him again, it'd be too soon. And I walked out of that house, and I never saw that man again. He died, and I never saw him again. And I'll tell you, that is the worst thing that this alcoholic ever did in his life. And I don't like to tell you about that, but I have to. Because it's not funny, and it's not humorous, and it's not easy to carry. And if you do it, it sticks in your throat like a bone, and you've all done it, and it has to be said. So I wrote that down. And I wrote down every other rotten thing I'd ever done in my life, too. The best I could. And I went through the list that suggested, write down the names of the people you hate, and why. I learned more from writing down the names of people I hated than from any other source in this fellowship. And I went through that ridiculous exercise that they suggest, the cardinal sins, you know, and wrote that down and did a little biography. Then I went to see a priest because I knew he couldn't squeal. Stood in line, went into the confessional, and all I wanted was 2 hours of his time with 44 people in line behind me. And he was a nice guy. It didn't work very well. Yeah, go ahead, go home. How many times you do it? 15, all right, don't worry about it, go home. Say 10 Our Fathers, 10 Hail Marys, and go in peace. And he meant well. He offered, he said, why don't you call me up, make an appointment, come see me, we can talk. I can't do it today. It didn't work. So I went to see my sponsor. And I told him just what I just told you, and what I had written down on that paper. And I didn't look him in the eye, I had my head down. And I told him every rotten thing that I had written down then. Very imperfectly. But it was the first attempt in a lifetime to lift the rock and see what was under there that's called Ed Lavelle. He nodded his head, crossed and uncrossed his legs a few times. When I got all finished, he says, is that all? I figured I made the confession of the century, and he says to me, is that all? And I said, yeah, that's all. He said, okay, we'll go from here. Two things happened to me as a result of that exercise, and I have to tell you what they are briefly. One, I learned something. I learned I didn't commit any original sins. Is there anybody in this audience who's sitting around here, whoever has sat there and thought, yeah, but you don't know how bad I was? Well, I know how bad you were. And the person next to you knows how bad you were. Because the person next to you has been where you were and has done what you did. And the only person who thinks they don't know is the person who's still holding it in, see? And when you say it, you join the human race. And saying it to my sponsor, Joe, was my ticket into this fellowship because I can look a man in the eye. I can look Flip H in the eye and tell him about me. And I don't have to dance, and I don't have to tell lies, and I don't have to put up cover stories. I'm a member of this fellowship, and I found that out too. And that's a tremendous ticket in. My sponsor, Joe, talked about other steps, and I'm not going to give you a blow-by-blow description of the applicability of all the 12 steps in my life because you've had to apply them in your life, but just let me tell you about a couple of them. He said to me when I got done telling him about my dad and about this series litany of faults and sins and confusion and resentments and hatreds, he said to me, you still have a mother? And I said, yeah. How long since she's heard from you? I said, 4 years, more or less. Does she know you're alive? I said, I don't know. Does she know where you're at? I don't have a clue. Why don't you go see her? I said, okay. Why don't you write to her first? If she's still alive, we wouldn't want her to die of shock if you walked in. So I wrote to my mom. I wrote to my mom, who was like, Dillinger's mom, my Johnny's not a bad boy, kind of thing. And I went home to see my mother, who was just as decent as my father was. And a decent soul. She had her faults, but she's a decent human being. And it was like the prodigal returning. I had brothers who didn't see it that way. They didn't want any part of me. They came to want parts of me later, but they didn't want any part of me. But I went back at the urging of my sponsor to see my mother and to visit my family. And I went back regularly And I went back routinely, and I went back forever until she died. In fact, I was with her when she died, and it was a great gift for me to be with her when she died. Amends is a trip that if you miss, you're missing one of the greatest rides in your life. Your life, your sake, your soul, not theirs. Don't know it prospectively. You only know it looking back. If you're lucky enough, as I am, to follow the directions when all else fails. I stayed in the Air Force and did all right. Years sober in the Air Force and really didn't want to go anywhere else. Life was fine and had been practicing the 11th step for my own sake, for my own soul, for my own recovery. Not because I'm a good man. Hope I'm a better man. I don't claim to be a good one. Try to be a good one. Try to be a good one. Not ashamed to say that I try to be a good one. Practicing prayer and meditation. Seeking knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out. And I was 14 years sober, and became clearer and clearer to me that I was supposed to be doing something a little bit different with my life. Not necessarily better, but different. And what kept coming up for me was a bit bizarre, considering that I had about 3 college credits or 6 college credits, and I picked those up haphazardly. What I was supposed to do with my life was go to college, get out of the Air Force, go to college, graduate, go to law school, become a lawyer, help people that can't help themselves. And when it became too uncomfortable to not do that, I went ahead and did get out and put one foot in front of the other, and I just report to you that that's exactly what did happen. I went through college, finished up, went through law school, graduated with honors, passed the bar, a couple of bar exams the first time around, and became what I am today, which is a trial attorney, and that doesn't define me. What defines me is my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. What can I tell you about life sober? I can tell you that for 32 years of my life, I have had the opportunity, at least in part, and I'd say in the major part, to be a participant in the adventure of life rather than a pest. You know what I mean? A pest. Alcoholics, at best, are pests when they drink. It's downhill from there, you know? You're a pest, and it goes downhill from there. You don't believe that? Look in your family. You still got a drunk in your family? On their best day, they're pests. They're worse than that. So what happens if you're sober and you participate in this fellowship, you become a little bit free, and you can become a useful human being, and become of some use to the people that you care about? And whose privilege is that? Theirs? Ours. Ours to be able to walk the earth like human beings instead of looking at our shoes, which is the position that new drunks take. I can always tell when I'm working with a new guy whether or not he's drinking, right? And that you can always tell. Because if he's sober, and he's newly sober, and you see him walking down the street, he's like this. He's looking at his shoes. He can tell you everything that's on the sidewalk and nothing about what's ahead of him. If he has a few drinks, he'd spit in your eye. So whenever I see a new guy that I sponsor with his head up walking down the street, right early in the game, I think, let me check his back pocket. See if he's got any of those funny powders around. And let me smell his breath and see if this, eau de cologne of Muscatel wine eking out of his pores, like used to eke out of my pores, the Muscatel, which was, you know, what fancy people drink. I got married after I was sober 4 years, and it was a disaster, and I got divorced not too many years beyond that, and stayed single for a long time, and got married again recently, and it's a happy marriage so far for the last couple of years. But I'll knock on wood, you know, it's so far so good, and I'm a very, very lucky guy. I have a son who's 24 years old, who was 25 years old, who was married last August, who never saw me take a drink, and we're as thick as thieves together, and he's a decent soul. He's never had a bad example from his old man. He may have his own bad examples, but he didn't get it from me, you know, not with the booze anyway. I will say this to you, that if you were to ask me, what do I think is the most important gift that I've gotten from AA, beyond not drinking, in sobriety, beyond not drinking, I'd say to you that I have been given the opportunity by God Almighty Himself, as expressed through this fellowship, to be a full participant in this fellowship. I have been given the opportunity to be of some use some of the time to some of the people that I dearly, dearly love in this world. And I would rather have that. I would rather be able to say that about myself than to say I was the most successful son of a gun that I ever met. Because it really is the people who are decent that we remember in this world. I served with a lot of men in the service, some of whom were very famous. They're not the ones I remember. The ones I remember are my gentle father, who was a total failure by the world's standards, but who never failed to reach his hand out to me when I was a child, and who I never took the opportunity to tell that I loved, and I wish I had. I will say to you that sobriety is the freest and the greatest gift that we alcoholics can receive, regardless of whatever else happens to us. If we can get sober and participate in this fellowship and join this fellowship, we receive, regardless of whatever else happens to us, the greatest gift I think that God can bestow on our kind in this life. I'm one of those. I'm one of those that can stand here before you and say, I was given this gift free. It came to me. Maybe I have to pay it back a little bit. Maybe I have to stand up here, you know, and do what I don't like to do. I don't like to do it at all. I'd rather take a kick in the behind with a number 11 army boot than stand up here and have to do what I'm trying to do tonight, because I don't like to do it. And most people don't like to do it, because you got to tell the truth. And if you got to tell the truth, it's hard to do. You can't go off on tangents. You can't go off on fairy tales. You can't go off on inventive arguments. You have to stick to what you know as experience and truth. And otherwise, it doesn't work. Otherwise, I can't look you in the eye. Otherwise, you know that I'm lying. Otherwise, you know that I'm full of it up to here. And my eyes don't turn blue, they turn brown, because I'm full of it right up to here. If I don't tell you the truth and look you in the eye. Where does this come from? It comes from God. Where do we get it? We got it from those that went before, didn't we? And every time I stand at an AA meeting, no matter whether I'm confused or whether I feel as if I'm brilliant, and this is not one of those nights, but whenever I stand at an AA meeting, I'll tell you that there are names that come back to me. And the names that come back to me are Joe, my sponsor, Huck, a first sergeant in the Army, Andy, another first sergeant in the Army, Rick, a platoon sergeant in the Army, and various other NCOs whose names I will recite, who are all dead, but in whose footsteps I walk. Because these were the guys that gave me the hand when I needed it. Now, I'll tell you this much. When I stand before you, it's in their name that I speak, because it's in their footsteps that I walk here. Thanks.